Joseph's character was refined and strengthened by his trials. Eventually, he rose up to become a prime minister of Egypt who saved thousands of lives and even his own family from starvation. If God had not allowed Joseph's years of suffering, he never would have been such a powerful agent for social justice and spiritual healing. Whenever I preach on this text, I hear from many people who identify with that narrative. Many people have to admit that most of what they really needed for success in life came to them through their most difficult and painful experiences. Some look back on an illness and recognize that it was an irreplaceable season of personal and spiritual growth for them. I have survived a bout with cancer, and my wife has suffered with Crohn's disease for years, and we would both attest to this. Though none of us are grateful for the tragedies themselves, we would not trade the insight, character, and strength we have gotten from them for anything. With time and perspective, most of us can see good reasons for at least some of the tragedy and pain that occurs in life. Why couldn't it be possible that, from God's vantage point, there are good reasons for all of them? If you have a God great and transcendent enough to be mad at because he hasn't stopped evil and suffering in the world, then you have at the same moment a God great and transcendent enough to have good reasons for allowing it to continue that you can't know. Indeed, you can't have it both ways. Evil and suffering may be, if anything, evidence for God. Horrendous inexplicable suffering, though it cannot disprove God, is nonetheless a problem for the believer in the Bible. However, it is perhaps an even greater problem for non-believers. C.S. Lewis described how he had originally rejected the idea of God because of the cruelty of life. Then he came to realize that evil was even more problematic for his new atheism. He finally realized that suffering provided a better argument for God's existence than one against it. He wrote, "My argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? Of course I could have given up my idea of justice by saying it was nothing but a private idea of my own. But if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust, not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. Consequently, atheism turns out to be too simple." Lewis recognized that modern objections to God are based on a sense of fair play and justice. People, we believe, ought not to suffer, be excluded, die of hunger or oppression. But the evolutionary mechanism of natural selection depends on death, destruction, and violence of the strong against the weak. These things are all perfectly natural. On what basis, then, does the atheist judge the natural world to be horribly wrong, unfair, and unjust? The non-believer in God doesn't have a good basis for being outraged at injustice, which, as Lewis points out, was the reason for objecting to God in the first place. If you are sure that this natural world is unjust and filled with evil, you are assuming the reality of some extra-natural or supernatural standard by which to make your judgment. The philosopher Alvin Plantinga said it like this: "Could there really be any such thing as horrifying wickedness if there were no God and we just evolved? I don't see how. There can be such a thing only if there is a way that rational creatures are supposed to live, obliged to live. A secular way of looking at the world has no place for genuine moral obligation of any sort, and thus no way to say that there is such a thing as genuine and appalling wickedness. Accordingly, if you think there is really such a thing as horrifying wickedness, and not just an illusion of some sort, then you have a powerful argument for the reality of God." In short, the problem of tragedy, suffering, and injustice is a problem for everyone. It is at least as big a problem for non-belief in God as for belief. It is therefore a mistake, though an understandable one, to think that if you abandon belief in God, it somehow makes the problem of evil easier to handle. A woman in my church once confronted me about sermon illustrations in which evil events turned out for good. She had lost a husband in an act of violence during a robbery. She also had several children with severe mental and emotional problems. She insisted that for every one story in which evil turns out for good, there are 100 in which there is no conceivable silver lining. In the same way, much of the discussion so far in this chapter may sound cold and irrelevant to a real-life sufferer. So what if evil and suffering doesn't logically disprove God, such a person might say? I'm still angry. All this philosophizing does not get the Christian God off the hook for the world's evil and suffering. In response, the philosopher Peter Kreft points out that the Christian God came to earth to deliberately put himself on the hook of human suffering. In Jesus Christ, God experienced the greatest depths of pain. Therefore, though Christianity does not provide the reason for each experience of pain, it provides deep resources for actually facing suffering with hope and courage, rather than bitterness and despair. The gospel narratives all show that Jesus did not face his approaching death with anything like the aplomb and fearlessness that was widely expected in a spiritual hero. The well-known Maccabean martyrs, who suffered under the Syrian rule of Antiochus Epiphanes, were the paradigms for spiritual courage in the face of persecution. They were famous for speaking defiantly and confidently of God, even as they were having limbs cut off. Contrast that with the demeanor of Jesus, who is depicted as profoundly shaken by his impending doom. In the Gospel of Mark we read, "He began to be deeply distressed and troubled, saying, 'My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death.'" In the Gospel of Luke, Jesus is described before his death as being in agony and describes a man with all the signs of being in physical shock. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all show Jesus trying to avoid death, asking the Father if there isn't some way out of it. "If it be your will," Jesus says, "take this cup from me." Finally, on the cross itself, Jesus does not, as the Maccabean martyrs, confidently call onlookers to be faithful to God. Rather, he cries out that God has forsaken him. On the cross, Jesus suffered a 3-hour-long death by slow suffocation and blood loss. As terribly painful as that was, there have been far more excruciating and horrible deaths that martyrs have faced with far greater confidence and calmness. Two famous examples are Hugh Latimer and Nicholas Ridley, who were burned at the stake at Oxford in 1555 for their Protestant convictions. As the flames leapt up, Latimer was heard to say calmly, "Be of good comfort, Mr. Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust never shall be put out." Why was Jesus so much more overwhelmed by his death than others have been, even more than his own followers? To understand Jesus' suffering at the end of the Gospels, we must remember how he is introduced at their beginning. The Gospel writer John, in his first chapter, introduces us to the mysterious but crucial concept of God as tripersonal. The Son of God was not created, but took part in creation and has lived throughout all eternity in the bosom of the Father, that is, in a relationship of absolute intimacy and love. But at the end of his life, he was cut off from the Father. There may be no greater inner agony than the loss of a relationship we desperately want. We can perhaps gauge the level of his suffering, abandonment, and rejection. If a mild acquaintance turns on you, condemns and criticizes you, and says she never wants to see you again, it is painful. If someone you're dating does the same thing, it is qualitatively more painful. But if your spouse does this to you, or if one of your parents does this to you, when you're still a child, the psychological damage is infinitely worse. We cannot fathom, however, what it would be like to lose not just spousal love or parental love that has lasted several years, but the infinite love of the Father that Jesus had from all eternity. Jesus' sufferings would have been eternally unbearable. Christian theology has always recognized that Jesus bore, as the substitute in our place, the endless exclusion from God that the human race has merited. In the Garden of Gethsemane, even the beginning and foretaste of this experience began to put Jesus into a state of shock. New Testament scholar Bill Lane writes, "Jesus came to be with the Father for an interlude before his betrayal, but found hell rather than heaven open before him, and he staggered." On the cross, Jesus' cry of dereliction, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is a deeply relational statement. Lane writes, "The cry has a ruthless authenticity. Jesus did not die renouncing God. Even in the inferno of abandonment, he did not surrender his faith in God, but expressed his anguished prayer in a cry of affirmation, 'My God, my God.'" Jesus still uses the language of intimacy, "my God," even as he experiences infinite and eternal separation from the Father. The death of Jesus was qualitatively different from any other death. The physical pain was nothing compared to the spiritual experience of cosmic abandonment. Christianity alone among the world religions claims that God became uniquely and fully human in Jesus Christ and therefore knows firsthand despair, rejection, loneliness, poverty, bereavement, torture, and imprisonment. On the cross, he went beyond even the worst human suffering and experienced cosmic rejection and pain that exceeds ours as infinitely as his knowledge and power exceeds ours. In his death, God suffers in love, identifying with the abandoned and God forsaken. Why did he do it? The Bible says that Jesus came on a rescue mission for creation. He had to pay for our sins so that someday he can end evil and suffering without ending us. Let's see where this has brought us. If we again ask the question, why does God allow evil and suffering to continue? And we look at the cross of Jesus, we still do not know what the answer is. However, we now know what the answer isn't. It can't be that he doesn't love us. It can't be that he is indifferent or detached from our condition. God takes our misery and suffering so seriously that he was willing to take it on himself. Albert Camus understood this when he wrote, "Christ the God-man suffers too, with patience. Evil and death can no longer be entirely imputed to him, since he suffers and dies. The night on Golgotha is so important in the history of man only because, in its shadows, the divinity ostensibly abandoned its traditional privilege and lived through to the end, despair included, the agony of death." Thus is explained the Lama Sabachthani and the frightful doubt of Christ in agony. So if we embrace the Christian teaching that Jesus is God and that he went to the cross, then we have deep consolation and strength to face the brutal realities of life on earth. We can know that God is truly Emmanuel, God with us, even in our worst sufferings. I think we need something more than knowing God is with us in our difficulties. We also need hope that our suffering is not in vain. Have you ever noticed how desperate the families of lost loved ones are to say that? They work to reform laws or to change social conditions that led to the death. They need to believe that the death of their loved ones has led to new life, that the injustice has led to greater justice. For the one who suffers, the Christian faith provides as a resource not just its teaching on the cross, but also the fact of the resurrection. The Bible teaches that the future is not an immaterial paradise, but a new heaven and new earth. In the book of Revelation, we do not see human beings being taken out of this world into heaven, but rather heaven coming down and cleansing, renewing, and perfecting this material world. The secular view of things, of course, sees no future restoration after death or history. And Eastern religions believe we lose our individuality and return to the great all soul, so our material lives in this world are gone forever. Even religions that believe in a heavenly paradise consider it a consolation for the losses and pains of this life and all the joys that might have been. The biblical view of things is resurrection. Not a future that is just a consolation for the life we never had, but a restoration of the life you always wanted. This means that every horrible thing that ever happened will not only be undone and repaired, but will in some way make the eventual glory and joy even greater. A few years ago, I had a horrible nightmare in which I dreamed that everyone in my family had died. When I awoke, my relief was enormous, but there was much more than just relief. My delight in each member of my family was tremendously enriched. I looked at each one, and I realized how grateful I was for them, how deeply I loved them. Why? My joy had been greatly magnified by the nightmare. My delight upon awakening took the terror up into itself, as it were, so that in the end my love for them was only greater for having lost them and found them again. This same dynamic is at work when you lose some possession you take for granted. When you find it again, having thought it was gone forever, you cherish and appreciate it in a far deeper way. In Greek, specifically Stoic philosophy, there was a belief that history was an endless cycle. Every so often the universe would wind down and burn up in a great conflagration called a palingenesia, after which history, having been purified, started over. But in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus spoke of his return to earth as the palingenesia. "I tell you the truth," he said, "at the renewal of all things," and that is the Greek word palingenesia, "the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne." This was a radically new concept. Jesus insisted that his return will be with such power that the very material world and universe will be purged of all decay and brokenness. All will be healed, and all might have beens will be. Just after the climax of the trilogy, Lord of the Rings, Sam Gamgee discovers that his friend Gandalf was not dead, as he thought, but alive. He cries, "I thought you were dead. But then I thought I was dead myself. Is everything sad going to come untrue?" The answer of Christianity to that question is yes. Everything sad is going to come untrue, and it will somehow be greater for having once been broken and lost. Embracing the Christian doctrines of the resurrection and cross brings profound consolation in the face of suffering. The doctrine of the resurrection can instill us with a powerful hope. It promises that we will get the life we most longed for, but it will be an infinitely more glorious world than if there had never been the need for bravery, endurance, sacrifice, or salvation. C.S. Lewis wrote, "They say of some temporal suffering, no future bliss can make up for it, not knowing that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory." This is the ultimate defeat of suffering and evil. It will not only be ended, but so radically vanquished that what has happened will only serve to make our future life and joy infinitely greater. Chapter 3, Christianity is a Straitjacket. Is a belief in absolute truth the enemy of freedom? Most people I've met in New York City believe that it is. Christianity names some beliefs heresy and some practices immoral. It bars from its community those who transgress its doctrinal and moral boundaries. This seems to contemporary observers to endanger civic freedom because it divides rather than unites our population. It also appears to be culturally narrow, failing to recognize that various cultures have different perspectives on reality. Finally, it seems to enslave or at least infantilize its members, determining what they must believe and practice in every particular. M. Scott Peck told of counseling a woman named Charlene who said about Christianity, "There's no room for me in that. That would be my death. I don't want to live for God. I will not. I want to live for my own sake." At the end of the movie I, Robot, the robot named Sonny has fulfilled the objectives in his design program. But now he realizes he no longer has a purpose. The movie concludes with a dialogue between Sonny and the other main character, Detective Spooner. Sonny says, "Now that I have fulfilled my purpose, I don't know what to do." Detective Spooner says, "I guess you'll have to find your own way like the rest of us, Sonny. That's what it means to be free." In this view, freedom means that there is no overarching purpose for which we were created. If there were, we would be obligated to conform to it and to fulfill it, and that is limiting. True freedom is freedom to create your own meaning and purpose. The Supreme Court has enshrined this view in law when it opined, "The heart of liberty is to define one's own concept of existence, of the meaning of the universe." Stephen Jay Gould concurs. He writes, "We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because comets struck the earth and wiped out dinosaurs, thereby giving mammals a chance not otherwise available. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists." This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We cannot read the meaning of life passively in the facts of nature. We must construct these answers for ourselves. Christianity looks like an enemy of social cohesion, cultural adaptability, and even authentic personhood. However, this objection is based on mistakes about the nature of truth, community, Christianity, and of liberty itself. The French philosopher Michel Foucault writes, "Truth is a thing of this world. It is produced only by multiple forms of constraint, and that includes the regular effects of power." Inspired by Foucault, Many say that all truth claims are power plays. When you claim to have the truth, you are trying to get power and control over other people. Foucault was a disciple of Nietzsche, and to their credit, they used this analysis on both the left and the right. If you claimed, "Everyone should do justice for the poor," in front of Nietzsche, he would question whether you said that because you really loved justice and the poor, or because you wanted to start a revolution that would give you control and power. However, the objection that all truth is a power play falls prey to the same problem as the objection that all truth is culturally conditioned. If you try to explain away all assertions of truth as one or the other or something else, you find yourself in an untenable position. C.S. Lewis writes in The Abolition of Man, "But you cannot go on explaining away forever. You will find that you have explained explanation itself away. You cannot go on seeing through things forever. The whole point of seeing through something is to see something through it. It is good that the window should be transparent, because the street or garden beyond it is opaque. How if you saw through the garden too? A wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see." If you say all truth claims are power plays, then so is your statement. If you say, like Freud, that all truth claims about religion and God are just psychological projections to deal with your guilt and insecurity, then so is your statement. To see through everything is not to see. Foucault was pressing the truth of his analysis on others even as he denied the very category of truth. Some kind of truth claim, then, seems unavoidable. The inconsistency of working against oppression when you refuse to admit there is such a thing as the truth is the reason that postmodern theory and deconstruction is perhaps on the wane. Christianity requires particular beliefs in order to be a member of its community. It is not open to all. This is socially divisive, critics argue. Human communities should instead be completely inclusive, open to all on the basis of our common humanity. Proponents of this view point out that many urban neighborhoods contain residents of different races and religious beliefs who nonetheless live and work together as a community. All that is required for such community life is that each person respects the privacy and rights of others and works for equal access to jobs, education, and political decision-making for all. Common moral beliefs are not necessary, it is said, in a liberal democracy. Unfortunately, the view just expressed is a vast oversimplification. Liberal democracy is based on an extensive list of assumptions: a preference of individual to community rights, a division between private and public morality, and the sanctity of personal choice. All of these beliefs are foreign to many other cultures. A liberal democracy is based, then, as is every community, on a shared set of very particular beliefs. Western society is based on shared commitments to reason, rights, and justice, even though there is no universally recognized definition of any of these. Every account of justice and reason is embedded in a set of some particular beliefs about the meaning of human life that is not shared with everyone. The idea of a totally inclusive community is, therefore, an illusion. Every human community holds in common some beliefs that necessarily create boundaries, including some people and excluding others, from its circle. Any community that did not hold its members accountable for specific beliefs and practices would have no corporate identity and would not really be a community at all. We cannot consider a group exclusive simply because it has standards for its members. Is there then no way to judge whether a community is open and caring rather than narrow and oppressive? Yes, there is. Here is a far better set of tests. Which community has beliefs that lead its members to treat persons in other communities with love and respect, to serve them and meet their needs? Which community's beliefs lead it to demonize and attack those who violate their boundaries rather than treating them with kindness, humility, and winsomeness? We should criticize Christians when they are condemning and ungracious to unbelievers. But we should not criticize churches when they maintain standards for membership in accord with their beliefs. Every community must do the same. Christianity is also reputed to be a cultural straitjacket. It allegedly forces people from diverse cultures into a single iron mold. It is seen as an enemy of pluralism and multiculturalism. In reality, Christianity has been more adaptive and maybe less destructive of diverse cultures than secularism and many other worldviews. The pattern of Christian expansion differs from that of every other world religion. The center and majority of Islam's population is still in the place of its origin, the Middle East. The original lands that have been the demographic centers of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Confucianism have remained so. By contrast, Christianity was first dominated by Jews and centered in Jerusalem. Later, it was dominated by Hellenists and centered in the Mediterranean. Later, the faith was received by the barbarians of Northern Europe, and Christianity came to be dominated by Western Europeans and then North Americans. Today, most Christians in the world live in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Christianity will soon be centered in the southern and eastern hemispheres. Two case studies are instructive. In 1900, Christians comprised 9% of the African population and were outnumbered by Muslims 4-1. Today, Christians comprise 44% of the population and in the 1960s passed Muslims in number. This explosive growth is now beginning in China. Christianity is growing not only among the peasantry, but also among the social and cultural establishment, including the Communist Party. At the current rate of growth, within 30 years, Christians will constitute 30% of the Chinese population of 1.5 billion. Why has Christianity grown so explosively in these places? African scholar Laman Sane gives a most intriguing answer. Africans, he said, had a long tradition of belief in a supernatural world of good and evil spirits. When Africans began to read the Bible in their own languages, many began to see in Christ the final solution to their own historic longings and aspirations as Africans. Sane argues that secularism, with its anti-supernaturalism and individualism, is much more destructive of local cultures and Africanness than Christianity is. In the Bible, Africans read of Jesus' power over supernatural and spiritual evil and of his triumph over it on the cross. When Africans become Christians, their Africanness is converted, completed, and resolved, not replaced with Europeanness or something else. Through Christianity, Africans get distance enough to critique their own traditions, yet still inhabit them. An interesting example of cultural adaptation is my own congregation, Redeemer Presbyterian Church of Manhattan. Its growth in this environment has surprised, even shocked, observers. I am repeatedly asked, how are you reaching thousands of young adults in such a secular place? The answer is that Christianity has done in New York City what it has done in all the other places that it has grown. It has adapted significantly and positively to the surrounding culture without compromising its main tenets. Redeemer's basic doctrines, the deity of Christ, the infallibility of the Bible, the necessity of spiritual rebirth through faith in Christ's atoning death, are in unity with the Orthodox supernaturalist beliefs of the Evangelical and Pentecostal churches of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the United States South and Midwest. These beliefs often put us in conflict with views and practices of many people in the city. At the same time, we have been delighted to embrace many other aspects of urban pluralistic culture. We emphasize the arts, value racial diversity, stress the importance of working for justice in the city for all its inhabitants, and communicate in the language and with the sensibility of our city center culture. Most of all, we stress the grace of a Savior who ate with people the establishment called sinners and loved those who opposed him. All of these things are very important to Manhattan residents. As a result, Redeemer attracts and reaches a very diverse urban congregation. At one Redeemer Sunday service, my wife Kathy was introduced to a man sitting in front of her, brought to church by John DeLorean. He was a speechwriter for a conservative Republican presidential candidate. Shortly thereafter, she was tapped on the shoulder by a woman sitting behind her who wanted to introduce her to another guest. She had brought to church a man who was Madonna's chief songwriter at the time. Kathy was delighted they were both there, but she hoped that they wouldn't meet each other before they'd heard the sermon. Some years ago, a man from a southern state visited Redeemer. He had heard that though we held to Orthodox Christian doctrine, we had grown large in the midst of a skeptical, secular city. He expected to find that we were attracting people with avant-garde music, video monitors and clips, dramatic sketches, exceptionally hip settings, and other kinds of eye-catching spectacle. To his surprise, he found a simple and traditional service that, on the surface, seemed identical to those in his more conservative part of the world. Yet he could also see that the audience contained many people who wouldn't have ever attended the churches he knew. After the service, he met me and said, "This is a complete mystery to me. Where are the dancing bears? Where are the gimmicks? Why are all these people here?" I directed him to some downtown art types who had been coming to Redeemer for some time. They suggested that he look beneath the surface. One person said that the difference between Redeemer and other churches was profound and lay in irony, charity, and humility. They said Redeemer lacked the pompous and highly sentimental language they found emotionally manipulative in other churches. Instead, Redeemer people addressed others with gentle, self-deprecating irony. Not only that, but beliefs were held here in charity and with humility, making a Manhattanite feel included and welcomed, even if they disagreed with some of Redeemer's beliefs. Most of all, they said, teaching and communication at Redeemer was intelligent and nuanced, showing sensitivity where they were sensitive. All of these emphases meet with approval in Manhattan, but each one is grounded in historic Christian doctrine. For example, the emphasis on racial diversity comes right out of St. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, in which Paul claims that the racial diversity of the church is an important witness to the truth of the Christian message. To take another example, Reinhold Niebuhr has pointed out that irony, amusement at seeing human beings try but fail to be godlike, is a very Christian way of looking at things. Because all these adaptive emphases have deep roots in historic Christian teaching, they are not simply marketing techniques. Why has Christianity, more than any other major religion of the world, been able to infiltrate so many radically different cultures? There is, of course, a core of teachings, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, the Ten Commandments, to which all forms of Christianity are committed. Nevertheless, there is a great deal of freedom in how these absolutes are expressed and take form within a particular culture. Contrary to popular opinion, then, Christianity is not a Western religion that destroys local cultures. Rather, Christianity has taken more culturally diverse forms than other faiths. It has deep layers of insight from the Hebrew, Greek, and European cultures, and over the next 100 years will be further shaped by Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Christianity may become the most truly Catholic vision of the world, having opened its leadership over the centuries to people from every tongue, tribe, people, and nation. Christianity is supposedly a limit to personal growth and potential because it constrains our freedom to choose our beliefs and practices. Immanuel Kant defined an enlightened human being as one who trusts in his or her own power of thinking rather than in authority or tradition. This resistance to authority in moral matters is now a deep current in our culture. Freedom to determine our own moral standards is considered a necessity for being fully human. This oversimplifies, however. Freedom cannot be defined in strictly negative terms as the absence of confinement and constraint. In fact, in many cases, confinement and constraint is actually a means to liberation. If you have musical aptitude, you may give yourself to practice the piano for years. This is a restriction, a limit on your freedom. There are many other things you won't be able to do with the time you invest in practicing. If you have the talent, however, the discipline and limitation will unleash your ability that would otherwise go untapped. What have you done? You've deliberately lost your freedom to engage in some things in order to release yourself to a richer kind of freedom to accomplish other things. This does not mean that restriction, discipline, and constraint are intrinsically, automatically liberating. For example, a 5'4", 125-pound young adult male should not set his heart on becoming an NFL lineman. All the discipline and effort in the world will only frustrate and crush him, literally. He is banging his head against a physical reality. He simply does not have the potential. In our society, many people have worked extremely hard to pursue careers that pay well rather than fit their talents and interests. Such careers are straitjackets that in the long run stifle and dehumanize us. Disciplines and constraints, then, liberate us only when they fit with the reality of our nature and capacities. A fish, because it absorbs oxygen from water rather than air, is only free if it is restricted and limited to water. If we put it out on the grass, its freedom to move and even live is not enhanced, but destroyed. The fish dies if we do not honor the reality of its nature. In many areas of life, freedom is not so much the absence of restrictions as finding the right ones, the liberating restrictions. Those that fit with the reality of our nature and the world produce greater power and scope for our abilities and a deeper joy and fulfillment. Experimentation, risk, and making mistakes bring growth only if, over time, they show us our limits as well as our abilities. If we only grow intellectually, vocationally, and physically through judicious constraints, why would it not also be true for spiritual and moral growth? Instead of insisting on freedom to create spiritual reality, shouldn't we be seeking to discover it and disciplining ourselves to live according to it? The popular concept that we should each determine our own morality is based on the belief that the spiritual realm is nothing at all like the rest of the world. Does anyone really believe that? For many years after each of the morning and evening Sunday services, I remained in the auditorium for another hour to field questions. Hundreds of people stayed for the give-and-take discussions. One of the most frequent statements I heard was that every person has to define right or wrong for him or herself. I always responded to the speakers by asking, is there anyone in the world right now doing things you believe they should stop doing no matter what they personally believe about the correctness of their behavior? They would invariably say, yes, of course. Then I would ask, doesn't that mean that you do believe there is some kind of moral reality that is there, that is not defined by us, that must be abided by regardless of what a person feels or thinks? Almost always the response to that question was a silence, either a thoughtful or a grumpy one. What then is the moral spiritual reality we must acknowledge in order to thrive? What is the environment that liberates us if we confine ourselves to it, like water liberates the fish? Love. Love is the most liberating freedom loss of all. One of the principles of love, either love for a friend or romantic love, is that you have to lose independence to attain greater intimacy. If you want the freedoms of love, the fulfillment, security, sense of worth that it brings, you must limit your freedom in many ways. You cannot enter a deep relationship and still make unilateral decisions or allow your friend or lover no say in how you live your life. To experience the joy and freedom of love, you must give up your personal autonomy. A love relationship limits your personal options. Again, we are confronted with the complexity of the concept of freedom. Human beings are most free and alive in relationships of love. We only become ourselves in love, and yet healthy love relationships involve mutual, unselfish service, a mutual loss of independence. Freedom, then, is not the absence of limitations and constraints, but it is finding the right ones, those that fit our nature and liberate us. For a love relationship to be healthy, there must be a mutual loss of independence. It can't just be one way. Both sides must say to the other, I will adjust to you. I will change for you. I'll serve you even though it means a sacrifice for me. If only one party does all the sacrificing and giving and the other does all the ordering and taking, the relationship will be exploitative and will oppress and distort the lives of both people. At first sight, then, a relationship with God seems inherently dehumanizing. Surely it will have to be one way, God's way. God, the divine being, has all the power. I must adjust to God. There is no way that God could adjust to and serve me. While this may be true in other forms of religion and belief in God, it is not true in Christianity. In the most radical way, God has adjusted to us in his incarnation and atonement. In Jesus Christ, he became a limited human being, vulnerable to suffering and death. On the cross, he submitted to our condition as sinners and died in our place to forgive us. In the most profound way, God has said to us in Christ, I will adjust to you. I will change for you. I'll serve you, though it means a sacrifice for me. If he has done this for us, we can and should say the same to God and others. St. Paul writes, the love of Christ constrains us. Once you realize how Jesus changed for you and gave himself for you, you aren't afraid of giving up your freedom and therefore finding your freedom in him. Chapter 4. The Church is Responsible for So Much Injustice. Mark Lilla, a professor at Columbia University, wrote an account for the New York Times magazine of his born-again experience as a teenager. During college, he deconverted and abandoned his Christian faith. How did it happen? Moving from Detroit to Ann Arbor, Michigan, he entered a Christian community that had a national reputation for spiritual vitality, but it turned out to be a crushing disappointment. The community was authoritarian and hierarchical, and the members were dogmatic, eager to bring me into line doctrinally. Disillusioned by the combative and exploitative way he thought they used the Bible to control people's lives, the thought penetrated my mind, he wrote, that the Bible might be wrong. It was my first step out of the world of faith. Many people who take an intellectual stand against Christianity do so against a background of personal disappointment with Christians and churches. We all bring to issues intellectual predispositions based on our experiences. If you have known many wise, loving, kind, and insightful Christians over the years, and if you have seen churches that are devout in belief, yet civic-minded and generous, you will find the intellectual case for Christianity much more plausible. If, on the other hand, the preponderance of your experience is with nominal Christians, who bear the name but don't practice it, or with self-righteous fanatics, then the arguments for Christianity will have to be extremely strong for you to concede that they have any cogency at all. Mark Lilla's determination that the Bible might be wrong was not a pure act of philosophical reflection. He was resisting the way that a particular person in the name of Christianity was trying to exercise power over him. So we have to address the behavior of Christians, individual and corporate, that has undermined the plausibility of Christianity for so many people. Three issues stand out. First, there is the issue of Christians' glaring character flaws. If Christianity is the truth, why are so many non-Christians living better lives than the Christians? Second, there is the issue of war and violence. If Christianity is the truth, why has the institutional church supported war, injustice, and violence over the years? Third, there is the issue of fanaticism. Even if Christian teaching has much to offer, why would we want to be together with so many smug, self-righteous, dangerous fanatics? Anyone involved in the life of a church will soon discover the many flaws in the character of the average professing Christian. Church communities seem, if anything, to be characterized by more fighting and party spirit than do other voluntary organizations. Also, the moral failings of Christian leaders are well known. It may be true that the press takes too much pleasure in publicizing them, but it doesn't create them. Church officials seem to be as, if not more, corrupt than leaders in the world at large. At the same time, there are many irreligious people who live morally exemplary lives. If Christianity is all it claims to be, shouldn't Christians on the whole be much better people than everyone else? This assumption is based on a mistaken belief concerning what Christianity actually teaches about itself. Christian theology has always taught what is known as common grace. In the book of James, we read, "Every good and perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights." This means that no matter who performs it, every act of goodness, wisdom, justice, and beauty is empowered by God. God gives out all good gifts of wisdom, talent, beauty, and skill graciously, that is, in a completely unmerited way. He casts them across all humanity, regardless of religious conviction, race, gender, or any other attribute to enrich, brighten, and preserve the world. Christian theology also speaks of the seriously flawed character of real Christians. A central message of the Bible is that we can only have a relationship with God by sheer grace. Our moral efforts are too feeble and falsely motivated to ever merit salvation. Jesus, through his death and resurrection, has provided salvation for us, which we received as a gift. All churches believe this in one form or another. Growth in character and changes in behavior occur in a gradual process after a person becomes a Christian. The mistaken belief that a person must clean up his or her own life in order to merit God's presence is not Christianity. This means, though, that the church will be filled with immature and broken people who still have a long way to go emotionally, morally, and spiritually. As the saying has it, the church is a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints. Good character is largely attributable to a loving, safe, and stable family and social environment, conditions for which we are not responsible. Many have had, instead, an unstable family background, poor role models, and history of tragedy and disappointment. As a result, they are burdened with deep insecurities, hypersensitivity, and a lack of self-confidence. They may struggle with uncontrolled anger, shyness, addictions, and other difficulties as a result. Now imagine that someone with a very broken past becomes a Christian, and her character improves significantly over what it was. Nevertheless, she may be still less secure and self-disciplined than someone who is so well-adjusted that she feels no particular need for religious affiliation at all. Suppose you meet both these women the same week. Unless you know the starting points and the life journeys of each woman, you could easily conclude that Christianity isn't worth much, and that Christians are inconsistent with their own high standards. It is often the case that people whose lives have been harder and who are lower on the character scale are more likely to recognize their need for God and turn to Christianity. So we should expect that many Christians' lives would not compare well to those of the non-religious, just as the health of people in the hospital is comparatively worse than people visiting museums. Doesn't Orthodox religion lead inevitably to violence? Christopher Hitchens, the author of God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, argues that it does. In his chapter entitled Religion Kills, he gives personal accounts of religion-fueled violence in Belfast, Beirut, Bombay, Belgrade, Bethlehem, and Baghdad. His argument is that religion takes racial and cultural differences and aggravates them. Religion is not unlike racism, he writes. One version of it inspires and provokes the other. Religion has been an enormous multiplier of tribal suspicion and hatred. Hitchens' point is fair. Religion transcendentalizes ordinary cultural differences so that parties feel they are in a cosmic battle between good and evil. This is why Hitchens argues that religion poisons everything, so it would seem. Christian nations institutionalized imperialism, violence, and oppression through the Inquisition and the African slave trade. The totalitarian and militaristic Japanese empire of the mid-20th century grew out of a culture deeply influenced by Buddhism and Shintoism. Islam is the soil for much of today's terrorism, while Israeli forces have often been ruthless in response. Hindu nationalists, in the name of their religion, carry out bloody strikes on both Christian churches and Muslim mosques. All of this evidence seems to indicate that religion aggravates human differences until they boil over into war, violence, and the oppression of minorities. There are problems with this view, however. The communist Russian, Chinese, and Cambodian regimes of the 20th century rejected all organized religion and belief in God. A forerunner of all these was the French Revolution, which rejected traditional religion for human reason. These societies were all rational and secular, yet each produced massive violence against its own people without the influence of religion. Why? Alistair McGrath points out that when the idea of God is gone, a society will transcendentalize something else, some other concept, in order to appear morally and spiritually superior. The Marxists made the state into such an absolute, while the Nazis did it to race and blood. Even the ideals of liberty and equality can be used in this way in order to do violence to opponents. In 1793, when Madame Roland went to the guillotine on trumped-up charges, she bowed to the statue personifying liberty in the Place de la Révolution and said, "Liberty, what crimes are committed in your name?" Violence done in the name of Christianity is a terrible reality and must be both addressed and redressed. There is no excusing it. In the 20th century, however, violence has been inspired as much by secularism as by moral absolutism. Societies that have rid themselves of all religion have been just as oppressive as those steeped in it. We can only conclude that there is some violent impulse so deeply rooted in the human heart that it expresses itself regardless of what the beliefs of a particular society might be, whether socialist or capitalist, whether religious or irreligious, whether individualistic or hierarchical. Ultimately, then, the fact of violence and warfare in a society is no necessary refutation of the prevailing beliefs of that society. Perhaps the biggest deterrent to Christianity for the average person today is not so much violence and warfare, but the shadow of fanaticism. Many non-believers have friends or relatives who have become born again and seem to have gone off the deep end. They soon begin to express loudly their disapproval of various groups and sectors of our society, especially movies and television, the Democratic Party, homosexuals, evolutionists, activist judges, members of other religions, and the values taught in public schools. When arguing for the truth of their faith, they often appear intolerant and self-righteous. This is what many people would call fanaticism. Many people try to understand Christians along a spectrum from nominalism at one end to fanaticism on the other. A nominal Christian is someone who is Christian in name only, who does not practice it and perhaps barely believes it. A fanatic is someone who is thought to overbelieve and overpractice Christianity. In this schematic, the best kind of Christian would be someone in the middle, someone who doesn't go all the way with it, who believes it but is not too devoted to it. The problem with this approach is that it assumes that the Christian faith is basically a form of moral improvement. Intense Christians would therefore be intense moralists or, as they were called in Jesus' time, Pharisees. Pharisaic people assume they are right with God because of their moral behavior and right doctrine. This leads naturally to feelings of superiority toward those who do not share their religiosity, and from there to various forms of abuse, exclusion, and oppression. This is the essence of what we think of as fanaticism. What if, however, the essence of Christianity is salvation by grace, salvation not because of what we do, but because of what Christ has done for us? Belief that you are accepted by God by sheer grace is profoundly humbling. The people who are fanatics, then, are not so because they are too committed to the gospel, but because they're not committed to it enough. Think of people you consider fanatical. They're overbearing, self-righteous, opinionated, insensitive, and harsh. Why? It's not because they're too Christian, but because they're not Christian enough. They are fanatically zealous and courageous, but they are not fanatically humble, sensitive, loving, empathetic, forgiving, or understanding, as Christ was. Because they think of Christianity as a self-improvement program, they emulate the Jesus of the whips in the temple, but not the Jesus who said, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone." What strikes us as overly fanatical is actually a failure to be fully committed to Christ and his gospel. Extremism and fanaticism, which lead to injustice and oppression, are a constant danger within any body of religious believers. For Christians, however, the antidote is not to tone down and moderate their faith, but rather to grasp a fuller and truer faith in Christ. The biblical prophets understood this well. In fact, the scholar Merrill Westfall documents how Marx's analysis of religion as an instrument of oppression was anticipated by the Hebrew prophets Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, and even by the message of the New Testament Gospels. Marx, according to Westfall, was unoriginal in his critique of religion. The Bible beat him to it. Jesus conducts a major critique of religion. His famous Sermon on the Mount does not criticize irreligious people, but rather religious ones. In his famous discourse, the people he criticizes pray, give to the poor, and seek to live according to the Bible, but they do so in order to get acclaim and power for themselves. They believe they will get leverage over others and even over God because of their spiritual performance. In Matthew's Gospel, Jesus says, "They think they will be heard for their many words." This makes them judgmental and condemning, quick to give criticism, and unwilling to take it. They are fanatics. In his teaching, Jesus continually says to the respectable and the upright, "The tax collectors and the prostitutes enter the kingdom before you." He continuously condemns in white-hot language their legalism, self-righteousness, bigotry, and love of wealth and power. We should not be surprised to discover it was the Bible-believing religious establishment who put Jesus to death. As Swiss theologian Karl Barth put it, it was the church, not the world, who crucified Christ. Jesus followed the lead of the Hebrew prophets, such as Isaiah, who said to the people of his day, "Day after day they seek me out. They seem eager to know my ways, as if they were a nation that does what is right and has not forsaken the commands of its God. They seem eager for God to come near them. Why have we fasted, they say, and you have not seen it? Why have we humbled ourselves, and you have not noticed? Yet on the day of your fasting, you do as you please and exploit all your workers. Is not this the kind of fasting I have chosen? To loose the chains of injustice, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? Is it not to share your food with the hungry, and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter when you see the naked, to clothe him? What were the prophets and Jesus criticizing? They were not against prayer and fasting and obedience to biblical directions for life. The tendency of religious people, however, is to use spiritual and ethical observance as a lever to gain power over others and over God, appeasing him through ritual and good works. This leads to both an emphasis on external religious forms, as well as greed, materialism, and oppression in social arrangements. Those who believe they have pleased God by the quality of their devotion and moral goodness naturally feel that they and their group deserve deference and power over others. The God of Jesus and the prophets, however, saves completely by grace. He cannot be manipulated by religious and moral performance. He can only be reached through repentance, through the giving up of power. If we are saved by sheer grace, we can only become grateful, willing servants of God and of everyone around us. Jesus charged his disciples, "Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be servant of all." In Jesus and the prophets' critique, self-righteous religion is always marked by insensitivity to issues of social justice, while true faith is marked by profound concern for the poor and the marginalized. The Swiss theologian John Calvin, in his commentaries on the Hebrew prophets, says that God so identifies with the poor that their cries express divine pain. The Bible teaches us that our treatment of them equals our treatment of God. While the church has inexcusably been party to the oppression of people at times, it is important to realize that the Bible gives us tools for analysis and unflinching critique of religiously supported injustice from within the faith. Historian C. John Somerville claims that even strong secular critics of Christianity are really using resources from within it to denounce it. Many criticize the church for being power-hungry and self-regarding. But there are many cultures in which the drive for power and respect is considered a good. Where then did we get this list of virtues by which we can discern the church's sins? Asks Somerville. We actually got it from within the Christian faith. To illustrate this point to his students, Somerville invites them to do a thought experiment. He points out that the pre-Christian Northern European tribes, like the Anglo-Saxons, had societies based on the concept of honor. They were shame-based cultures in which earning and insisting upon respect from others was paramount. The Christian monks who were trying to convert them had a set of values based on charity, on wanting the best for others. To see the difference, he asks his students to imagine seeing a little old lady coming down the street at night carrying a big purse. Why not just knock her over and take that purse and its money? The answer of an honor and shame culture is that you do not take her purse, because if you pick on the weak, you would be a despicable person.